Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and a very happy budget day to you all. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today for our roundtable discussion on the week in Washington and beyond, our former Pentagon Comptroller, Bob Hale, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, retired United States Marine Corps Major General and former Senate Armed Services Committee Staff Director, Arnold Panaro, who is now the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association, and with the Panaro Group Consultancy, former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dove Zakheim, who among his many roles serves as a senior advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And joining us also is our producer, Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander and public affairs officer, who is also the co-founder of the ProVision Advisors public relations firm. Everybody, happy budget day, and thanks very much for joining us. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and cyber coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems is sponsoring our air and missile defense coverage. The Biden administration has submitted its long-awaited first budget to Congress today that includes $715 billion for defense. That includes a slight increase in research and development for hypersonics, artificial intelligence, big data, cyber, 5G, and other technologies, but also slightly shrinks acquisition spending. Nuclear modernization has been prioritized, with the Columbia ballistic missile submarine getting support, the ground-based strategic deterrent to replace the Minuteman being supported, as well as investment going to the B-21 bomber. But there are cuts to the Army, including to vehicle programs, and a slight reduction in Navy shipbuilding. Some legacy programs are being retired or pared back. Four littoral combat ships will be decommissioned, as well as A-10 attack planes, KC-135 and KC-10 aerial tankers. C-130H transports will be mothballed. Fewer F-15 EX airplanes will be acquired, but a slight increase in the F-35 stealth fighter readiness spending would go up, as well as investment for the Pacific Defense Initiative, as well as the acquisition of 5 used ships to improve U.S. sealift capabilities. Spending will also rise on climate-related investment for military infrastructure. Military and civilian pay would also be increased, along with quality of life improvements. But for all the talk of a whole-of-government response, the White House budget fact sheet neglected to mention the words defense, military, great power competition, or China. This as the president of the United States today was speaking at Joint Base Langley Eustis as his administration was rolling out the budget. Briefers acknowledged that there would be a dividend related to the Afghanistan pullout that is going to be achieved well beyond the president's September 11 deadline. Everybody, thanks again very much for joining us. Bob, you are the most recent Pentagon comptroller on this line. Without any disrespect to Dove, you preceded Mike McCord, who is doing a reprise, having been confirmed by the Senate Armed Services Committee, and will be sworn in next week as the Undersecretary of Defense. Talk to us a little bit about what you make of this budget, what the administration got right, got wrong. I want to get everybody's thoughts about whether or not the rhetoric of this administration matches the reality, because our understanding from folks in the administration and the joint staff is that this is sort of a joint staff document and includes many of the things that would have been in a Trump budget, albeit maybe with a little bit less money.
Well, Vago, thanks for being here. I think we've only seen these numbers for a short period, so you'll get a quick review. There does seem to be a theme in the numbers, and that is we are going to take on the Chinese with innovation. The budget shows R&D up about 5.3%, even though the whole budget is up only 1.6%. So it's clearly an R&D emphasis. Maybe even more important is a very sharp increase, almost 12%, in what's called advanced component development and prototypes. In other words, they're starting to make some bets, or they're planning to make some bets on specific R&D initiatives in the fiscal year 22 budget. But there's not much growth in the overall budget, barely enough, probably not enough, quite enough to keep up with inflation. So the bill payers here, as you mentioned, Vago, are an aggressive set of decommissionings, which will surely be contentious on the Hill. Their budget documents show they're going to save a little less than $3 billion by decommissioning older weapons, an important amount of money for them as they try to keep the overall budget flat in real terms and still focus on R&D. And the other bill payer is procurement, down about 5.8%, which means we're going to take some risks with a force that's already pretty old in many cases and is probably going to get somewhat older. So a quick look, an R&D emphasis for sure in this budget and some bets on R&D, but some bill payers as well and decommissioning and also procurement. With that, let my colleagues have a shot.
And I just want to very quickly say for our audience, thanks very much for that summary, Bob. But, you know, we are taping this just as the budget briefings are continuing because we want to get this program to our audience on what is the first major holiday weekend as the nation reemerges from the pandemic. Maybe Chris can talk to us a little bit about the communication strategy and the challenges associated. Dove, I want to get your sense and then go to you, Arnold, and get your take as well, and how Congress is likely to welcome this. Many of the trade-offs that are in this budget have been trade-offs that were tried many, many years ago, whether it was on KC-10s or on A-10s and ship reductions. I think Anne McAndrew, who is performing the duties of the comptroller, made clear is that, you know, the administration stands ready to work with members of Congress, given that that's usually the hangup whenever this happens. But Dove, give us your sense on what the administration has gotten right, gotten wrong, because obviously there is an expectation that bigger muscle movements will happen, and that will be in the 23 budget, as several in the administration have told us. Talk to us about your sense.
The first thing is the impact, I think, on both our European allies and partners, and on our Asian allies and partners, that the word defense did not appear at all in the White House, in the official statement coming out of OMB. And the reason I say that is that there has been so much of anticipation of a different kind of attitude on the part of this administration vis-a-vis the Trump administration. And then not to have anything said at all at the White House level, I think is going to get people wondering again. And speaking to Europeans, you're going to hear that. So that, for instance, combined with the fact that right now we don't even have an aircraft carrier in the Pacific, we've moved it to the Middle East, that's going to get people scratching their heads as to what do we really plan to do. So that's number one. Number two is there had been so much talk about reducing Army force level and strength. Didn't happen. And the Army is keeping its end strength, as I understand it. Again, like Bob, I think I had even less time than Bob to actually look at the details. But if they're keeping end strength, as I believe they are, and of course they're paying for it, then again, you have to kind of wonder how much in the way of, you know, really serious trade-offs are taking place here. So there's that as well. And finally, yes, they're putting money into hypersonics, into AI, into all the things they recognize they've got to do if they're going to keep up with China. But again, where was the discussion of the great power competition, and why wasn't that highlighted at all? It just seems to me that this budget this year is even more of a holding pattern than I thought it would be. Clearly, they're pointing, there are indicators, and fiscal 23 may well be the time when they really change the course of what they want to do. But again, I mean, one thing you mentioned, Vago, was the slight, I think you used the word slight cut in Navy procurement for shipbuilding and conversion. In fact, Trump had planned on 12 ships, and they're giving them 8. Well, that's not a slight cut. That's a 33% cut. And that also begs the question, okay, the Army hasn't been reduced at all. Navy ships are being cut. What exactly is going on here? And as I say, I think a lot of people are going to be puzzled even before Congress gets its teeth into it. And for that one, I'll turn over to my colleague Arnold, who knows more about Congress than I'll ever know.
A part of it is a reduction in the rate of increase, because on the way out the door, the Trump administration did, I think, unrealistically boost the number. And I shouldn't have said slight, right? I mean, it is was 12 in the last budget, and it's being it's been reduced in this one. So it's more than slight, and thanks for the correction on that. Arnold, what's your sense on where we are, what this all means, and how members are likely to respond to it at the end of the day? Because members speak with forked tongue on this, I think, to put it mildly, right? On the one hand, they're pushing for change. On the other hand, and to get ready for this competition, on the other hand, they don't want to get rid of any legacy system that would freeze resources. What's your sense on sort of the document and where we've ended up?
Well, as my colleagues on this call know, no president's budget survives contact with the Congress. This one will be no different. And if you look sort of at the big blue arrows or the strategic direction, we don't have any caps on discretionary spending in defense for the first time in over 10 years, but we have a debt ceiling overhang, and that's what brought us the caps and sequesters 10 years ago. So we don't know yet what the deficit hawks are going to demand and do. But let's say we get through the debate on the deficit. The debate on the top line, frankly, in Congress is going to be between the $715 billion in the Biden budget and the 1% to 2% higher that's being pushed by the defense hawks. And I think in the Senate, they're going to have a lot of leverage to get it up a bit, because it's going to be tied to the Biden wanting 16% increase in the domestic discretionary spending. So that's where kind of the debate on the top line is going to be. Those that are advocating for a 10% or deep cut in defense, they just flat don't have the votes. Now, the worry is, as Bob and Dove has said, we're flat through the FYDP, according to the OMB numbers. The other thing in Congress is the authorization and appropriation bills. They're not going to be finalized until after Thanksgiving and closer to Christmas. They're not even going to begin to mark the bills up until late into July in the House in September. We're going to start the year in a continuing resolution, just like we have for the last 20 years. But FY22 is flat to FY21. So spending levels are constant. But of course, CRs are horrible for the department. And there is a bipartisan agreement, obviously, that China's the pacing threat. And I would say this is, I don't call this a skinny budget. I call it a hefty budget, because in constant dollars, it's higher than the peak of the Reagan buildup. But you got to look at what they buy for that money. I would also underscore Congress in recent years has not supported DOD proposals that reduce programs, particularly ones that have large number of jobs attached to them. And they frankly have not been able, willing to constrain benefits to personnel. So those costs continue to climb. And so you basically then get the squeeze between procurement, O&M, and the various accounts. I would also say the Pentagon and administration funding priorities on climate and COVID are going to be challenged in the Congress. Some of it will get through, but it's not clear to me at the highest levels, because Congress basically in this budget is going to have to cut to add in their priorities. So I it's going to kind of be a congressional business as usual year, but I do worry about the debt ceiling overhang and kind of what that fight might portend. I don't think anybody will agree to another sequester, but we don't know how this is going to play out. Over.
Chris, what's your sense on some of this messaging? You and I have had so many conversations of this over the past couple of days, weeks, and months, indeed. And I should point out one of our frequent number is Michael Baer, former Defense Business Board chair, who has talked on this podcast before about the importance of building sort of that bigger narrative, right? So that the administration builds that case, that support, especially in 23, if it was going to make major muscle movements, right? I mean, there are some folks who are deeply disappointed that this didn't move as many muscles as folks had hoped, even if it was not, a negative document, right? But Chris, give us your sense on, everything from announcing this on a Memorial Day weekend to the substance of it from your standpoint.
When you look at the fact that the budget was several months later than people expected, the fact that it was released on the Friday before a holiday weekend, the fact that during the rollout, President of the United States was speaking at the exact same time, splitting the defense press between covering the president and covering the rollout. The fact that they only took three questions from the Pentagon press corps during that briefing. Kath Hicks, the undersecretary of defense, or the deputy secretary of defense, who spoke first to kind of lay out the big themes today, took no questions. from my experience in the Pentagon, all of those lines cross and you're left with the idea that this is not a budget. This is not an issue that this team wants to talk about, that they want a lot of attention given to. Juxtapose that to the level of detail that was in the White House budget or the OMB budget memo that Dove and Bob mentioned, that really did kind of go through domestic program after domestic program and laud where the money was. And then there's no mention of defense in that. There's no, the word China doesn't show up. The word competition doesn't show up. I guess if I was looking at it from a half full, I would say that, hey, look, I mean, they did the budget, they did the best they could, and you know, they're gonna deal with it when it gets over to Congress, as Arnold mentioned. I can't help but kind of go, meh. I mean, you know, I had hoped for more. I had really hoped that this team would come in and that there would be something either in the budget priorities that showed up in the budget or in the communication of those priorities in the rollout that showed that we were serious from a whole of government, from a whole of national security team at competing with China. And I felt like this rollout fell short. Again, it's day one. We're only a couple hours into it. Maybe the team is going to spend the next couple weeks, you know, beating that drum. But the early indication is that this is not something that they want to give a lot of priority over.
There is that, right? So if you talk to folks in the administration, they'll say that at the joint session of Congress, the president did make clear the imperative, the focus on China, great power competition, and that it's not necessary to repeat it. On the other hand, I just speak to the collective, two centuries of defense experience that exists on this call. Repetition is critical, especially from a leadership standpoint, so that there is that alignment and you are constantly reinforcing that message. Michael, let me bring you into the discussion. I know that you've paid, you might be the only guy in Washington who has not paid as close attention to this budget, in part because there are other client issues that you're obviously working with defense spending and a process that's still underway. But talk to us a little bit about, you know, whatever feedback you have gotten from members up there on any of this at this point and any sense you've gotten. And then more specifically, you know, where we are on some of the issues that you've been tracking for us. Obviously, Republicans have officially in the Senate, Senate Republicans have officially rejected the notion of January 6th commission. That was the case also in the House. Now it looks like Democrats may move ahead on that. And then there's been a to and fro on infrastructure. That discussion continues. And there is a sense, at least I know from president and his party, that Republicans really aren't very serious at coming. You know, they want to give the appearance that they're negotiating and that they want to achieve some sort of middle ground, but they don't want to fund anything that's in the core of what the president wants, which is climate and energy. Right, which is the whole, you know, part of the importance of what the president's trying to achieve. Give us your sense on all of this.
Okay, great. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. So first, starting with the budget, since that's been what we've been talking about so far. I have talked with several members of the Armed Services Committee this week, and there's been a little, you know, frustration from some of the senior Democrats that Republicans keep saying they want a higher top line, they want more money, but they can't explain what they want that money for. However, now that the budget's out, they will be able to say where they feel the shortfalls are and where they want that money spent. Right away upon the budget release, Senator Inhofe and Ranking Member Mike Rogers sent out a joint statement attacking the defense budget request, saying it's wholly inadequate, saying it's nowhere enough to give our service members the resources and equipment and training that they need. They actually say it's disingenuous to call this an increase because it doesn't keep up with inflation. It doesn't adequately resource the 2018 National Defense Strategy. And lastly, they feel it sends a bad signal to adversaries like China. But we were talking also about, and Chris was, I think, very, very accurate about, you know, why they were rolling out this budget so late on a holiday weekend. And I think that's right. They don't want as much attention paid to this. And I've talked to several operatives today and yesterday about the late rollout. And it's a feeling that Biden wants more attention paid to infrastructure. That's his focus right now. And right. There's been a lot of activity this week. The Democrats, the White House gave the Republicans another offer of about $1.7 trillion. They were as high originally as about $2.5 trillion. And the Republicans gave a counteroffer yesterday of just under $1 trillion. But immediately, many of the Senate Democrats slammed that counteroffer. Folks like Sherrod Brown came out saying they refused to go big. Senator Bernie Sanders said it doesn't go near enough. Senator Schatz called it minuscule. And then we're talking about $1 trillion, right? Right.
Right.
But and we also
only in Washington exactly. is $1 trillion not a lot of money. Right.
Right. Minuscule. I mean, right.
Minuscule. Holy yes. sweet fancy right. Moses.
Exactly. So, you know, and then you have the added problem of you have other many Democratic senators putting down markers. For example, Senator Markey saying if no meaningful climate action is in this bill, then there's no deal with Democrats. But there were several Senate Democrats that were very complimentary of this counterproposal. Both Senator Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema praised the effort and the counterproposal that Shelley Moore Capito has been leading. But most importantly, President Biden himself, you know, called Capito after she released the proposal and has invited her and Republicans to the White House to continue discussions next week. And on top of that, Mitch McConnell even came out and saying that he's willing to up the ante even more. So it's possible Republicans are willing to go up above $1 trillion. So there really is a very stark glimmer of hope here that there really could be a bipartisan compromise on infrastructure. However, it would be predominantly on the things that how Republicans define infrastructure, you know, public transit, water systems, airports, rail, you know, things like that, right? It would not include the things that we've talked about on previous podcasts, you know, the R&D money that would go into technological innovation to challenge, you know, China and other things like that. But, you know, I think that, you know, the more the Republicans keep coming to the table, the longer this drags out. Also, you know, from a tactical standpoint, it really slows down in the Republicans' eyes, the Biden, Pelosi, Schumer legislative process. And I think there's a recognition that that's really going to be the case, that these deadlines that they've set for infrastructure are not going to happen. You remember, you know, we talked in previous podcasts that they were going to be able to unlock an extra reconciliation vehicle from FY21. There's some sense now that they're probably not going to be able to use that because they'd have to do that by September 30th. So they're going to have to use the reconciliation vehicles that would come with FY22, which means we're going to have to pass a budget resolution first. So it's very possible infrastructure drags out into the fall. And if they are able to come up with this bipartisan compromise, I then think that the president would possibly try to do something to reconciliation for all the other things Democrats want, as well as a lot of those bill payers. I think that stands very, very limited chance of success. You also asked about the January 6th commission. So there was some action in the Senate today, one on the January 6th commission, which again, failed. Only six Senate Republicans voted in favor of it. But that does not mean the end of the investigations in January 6th. I think it's very likely that the Democrats set up special committees to investigate this. So I think in some respects, it may be a miscalculation by Republicans because this issue is not going away. They would also hope to vote on the Endless Frontiers Act today, which has been renamed the American Innovation and Competition Act. But that vote now has been postponed until June 8th. And it's significant because there's a lot of anti-China sentiment on Capitol Hill. We talked about that in terms of the budget. You know, how does this address China? We've seen a supply chain task force get created on the House Armed Services Committee. Just earlier today, every single Republican House member signed a letter to Nancy Pelosi requesting that she instruct her committee chairman to immediately join Republicans to hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable for its role in causing the pandemic. There's mounting evidence that the pandemic started in a Chinese lab and the Chinese covered it up. So they feel the Chinese are responsible and they want Congress to investigate that. But then this Endless Frontiers bill that's been in the works for a while in both the House and the Senate, but the action's really been the Senate, is really aimed at countering China. It's about almost a $200 billion bill. And there's a lot of implications here for the U.S. military. I mean, the centerpiece of this bill really is an allotment to the Commerce Department to stand up semiconductor development and manufacturing, research development incentives. But there's a focus on the military, automakers, and other critical industries. It directs the president to impose sanctions on China for various actions relating to what they consider malign influence. It would authorize almost $40 billion for foreign military financing in the Indo-Pacific. And it would expand Buy American requirements and broaden programs to secure U.S. supply chain. So, you know, I think the question is, where's the money going to come from this? And I think this also if this bill does become law, helps make up for some of the things that might not end up in the infrastructure package.
I want to go just get some remembrances in a moment for on the passing of a great American, the late great Senator John Warner, veteran of both World War II as well as the Korean War, and certainly one of the most influential and respected senators who served as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and somebody who Arnold worked with very closely, and many of you did. But I want to just quickly ask if there are any wrap-up thoughts from everybody, from anybody else on the budget. Bob, I think you've got something.
Yeah, two things, Vago. First, the numbers may be a little better for defense than they appear, and that there is an OCO dividend when you dig in on it in too much time, but even the department acknowledges there's probably $10 billion of direct war spending that's going to go away, and they pocketed. And second, I mean, we always criticize defense for not establishing priorities. Some of my colleagues have done it. There are priorities, I think, in this budget. I mean, it's a clearly R&D heavy procurement. They cut procurement. You can question that, but we clearly, I think, seeking to spend more to get ready for the next conflict and take some risks with an older force. And some fairly, by defense standards, sharp changes in service budget shares. The Army is actually down 1% in its money, the Air Force and Navy up 2-4% each. So there are some priorities in this budget, and I think the pain was eased a little by the OCO dividend. Back to you, Vago.
Any last thoughts from anybody else on the team before we go to remember Senator Warner?
Vago, I would say, I would underscore what Bob Hale said, because the investment accounts, procurement, R&D, a total of $245 billion. That's an enormous amount of money. We would have killed in our day for, you know, when it was over under $100 billion. So there's some very robust areas of this budget. The big question is, what are they spending it on, and how much are we getting for what we spend?
Vago, I have one thought as well. There's a NATO summit coming up, and President is going to be meeting with his counterparts, and it's going to be very interesting to see how he deals with their concerns, given what we've just been talking about for the last half hour. Maybe he will use that as an opportunity to underscore what he is doing with our allies and for our allies in the defense realm, because clearly there are going to be question marks.
Dove, that was both a great question and a brilliant suggestion, right? Effectively, the president should take that as an opportunity, almost as a mulligan, to cast all of what's happening in that more integrated manner that I think they so clearly missed an opportunity to do so, right? Even though, and that was, I think, in my sense, just to support what you're saying, especially since you're using a warmed over skeleton or most of the foundational principles that were set by the preceding administration, I think it was all the more important to put your own mark on this, especially if you're talking about whole of government, because if the White House is not doing that whole of government, then it's really just empty rhetoric. Cervello?
As each of the folks have said, I mean, this will play out over the next couple of weeks, months, if not longer. To me, we have hit rock bottom and we can only go up. And I think it's important to look at. We're coming out of Afghanistan. I cannot foot stomp heavy enough as a former Navy guy how troubling it is that we have to bring an aircraft carrier from the Pacific to Central Command to oversee the removal of those troops and to make sure that everything goes smoothly. It has to get better from here. So if you look at where we are and where the administration wants to go, there is a ton of work to do. And I hope that as this budget is deliberated on, and as the 23 budget is, or excuse me, the 23 budget is put together and the priorities really seem to take hold, that we remember where we are now and where we need to go, because we, you know, moving carriers across the world, not having forces as ready as they need to be, as Dove says, it is only going to embolden our adversaries, and it's only going to make our allies look around for somebody else to back and to partner with.
Let me ask a quick question about littoral combat ship, very, very briefly before we move on. there are going to be six of the ships, Cervello, correct me if I'm wrong, right? In total, six of the ships will be retired. These four that are going to be retired, right? Because the first two have already been retired. Independence and Freedom have already been retired, if I'm correct. You're looking at four ships that will never have deployed that will be retired. Everybody understands KC-135s that were built in the Eisenhower administration, rode hard, put away wet, 40-year-old KC-10s, 40-year-old A-10s, whose mission may be going away in a great power universe, right? A close air support airplane that was vital in 20 years of Afghanistan and Iraq. You could justify it. You could keep them in service. A little bit less reason to have them around now. Is this going to be the sort of thing that has people looking at this and going, so let me see if I get this straight. We're retiring $2 billion plus of warships that have almost no mileage on them and might still have an air freshener hanging in the bridge.
Right. They still have that new ship smell.
They have that. They do have that new ship smell. Do. I've been on them.
There's a discussion of that in their overview. Two of the ships that are new don't have their mission packages, and they've decided that they don't want to spend the money to put those packages on them. And two of them, I think, are used, but have had, according to the Department of Defense, serious propulsion problems that are going to require major overhauls, and they decided not to spend the money. So there were reasons they had, at least, for why those four ships were chosen.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. But on the other hand, those ships were, and I've mentioned this on previous podcasts, because I was the first one to fund them, that the whole concept of these ships was turned upside down. They are not what was originally intended for them to be, number one. Number two, there was too much co-development. And number three, there never really was a sense, and this is not something that could have happened on my watch or even on Bob Hale's watch. It should have happened much earlier, that how these ships would really and truly fit in to what the Navy was trying to do. And if you take all those three factors, plus what Bob just said, you come up with a disastrous program. And by the way, this isn't the first time it's happened to the Navy with smaller ships. Those of you who are of a certain age will remember the Patrol hydrofoils. Same kind of problem. The Navy has a lot of trouble getting its arms around any ship that's less than 8,000 or 9,000 tons. And as long as that continues, that'll be a problem. And of course, now that they're talking about unmanned and partially manned, we have to see whether Congress will go along with it, because that really would be a breakthrough.
I think both of you are right. And I think that for me, it all kind of is part of that us hitting rock bottom, right? I wish the Navy's problems were only LCS deep, but they're struggling to figure out what they're going to do with DDG 1000, which is a very big ship, which has a lot of capability on it. Now they're talking about removing the gun. None of those ships, the two ships that are in the fleet and the one that is still left to be delivered, those ships haven't deployed. They're going to remove the gun. They're going to try to put hypersonics or lasers or something. And so again, it's all, for me, it's part of that argument that it can't get much worse if we are going to try to get to a place where we can effectively compete with the Chinese and the Russians.
I couldn't agree.
Well, I think it could get a lot worse, I'd say to Chris. Go back to 2013 when we took a 30% cut in half of the year because of the U.S. Congress, and it couldn't get its act together. So I don't think we've hit rock bottom. I think we're a lot better off than we were at some periods within the last 5 or 7 years.
The ship is turning. And that's great. We are starting to do some of the things that are required. The question is the rate at which we can do these things, which obviously is important. The three ships that we're talking about in the DDG 1000 class are the Zumwalt, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and the Michael Mansour. Obviously, Elmo Zumwalt takes you to his colleague and boss was John Warner, who was Secretary of the United States Navy between 1972 and 1974. went on to become a great senator from the state of Virginia and an influential and thoughtful member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and also one of the true gentlemen that I've ever had the honor and pleasure of interviewing and talking to, and very much enjoyed my relationship with Senator Warner, as limited as it was. I want to open it up to you guys. Arnold, you wrote a very moving piece on behalf of NDIA, and you, why don't you start us off, because I think you work more closely with Senator Warner than anybody else, and then Dove would like to get your sense, Bob, yours as well, because everybody who's been involved in defense had interactions regularly with Senator Warner when he was in the department, but also out of office. It was astonishing how sharp and thoughtful he remained until his recent passing from a heart attack at the age of 94. And I should note that he was a third-class petty officer in the United States Navy in World War II, and then a Marine aviation maintenance officer during the Korean War, and benefited from the GI Bill, and obviously went on to get his law degree, and obviously a bright career in politics. But Arnold, start us off.
Well, Vago, I had the great privilege of working with Senator Warner for over 20 years in the U.S. Senate when I was working for Senator Nunn, and the two of them were very close personal friends and professional friends. I saw him almost every day, and then I worked on a lot of projects with him after he left for the last decade and a half. He was an individual that always put the country's interest ahead of his personal interests. He always led from the front. He was an incredibly accomplished public servant. You've mentioned his war records. He was very bipartisan in his approach. He and Senator Nunn teamed up on a lot of things. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the late 70s, when the all-volunteer force was falling apart and about to go under, Senator Nunn and Senator Warner put a package of benefits together that became known as the Nunn-Warner Benefits Package, opposed strongly by the Carter administration and the power at the time. But the two of them made a powerful case to the Senate and to the House and got passed. By the way, the program was initiated by the then captain in the United States Navy and the Navy Senate liaison officer named John McCain, who worked very closely with them and with many on this call as well. Another example was he and Senator Nunn worked together to improve the communication link with Russia in the peak of the Cold War to avoid accidental nuclear war. The communication link had gotten rusty, and they did an initiative to fix that. Another interesting trip we took to a lot of war zones, Just Cause in Panama, Desert Shield, Desert Storm. So when we were traveling out there at the request of Secretary Cheney and General Powell, Senator Warner and I went to visit the battleship USS Wisconsin. And Senator Warner went into, and I was with him, went in the gun turret of the big 16-inch guns. And I marveled at how he explained to the gun crewmen how to work the guns. I mean, here he was, long out of uniform in the Navy, and he still understood how to work those battleships. And another humorous thing about Senator Warner, he was a big collector of items. We had a submarine model in the Committee on Armed Services. He saw it one day and took it for his office. I had a picture of John Paul Jones in my office. He liked it so much, he absconded with that. If you wore a tie that he liked, he would want to take it from you, but the next couple of days, you'd get a nice new tie in return. He was just an all-around great human being. The former Secretary of the Navy, Will Ball, and I used to, go to breakfast or lunch with him at the Metropolitan Club quite frequently in recent years. And he was everybody loved to see John Warner. He could remember everything about what he did in the past. He will be sorely, sorely missed, but what an example for anybody that would want to aspire to be a great government servant today. Over.
Dove?
Well, first I'll reiterate everything Arnold just said. To me, he was just an extremely decent gentleman, both when I was undersecretary and after. And just one story, which I heard he would tell to others as well. I was going to do my courtesy call with him. And of course I knew him, but you still had to do that sort of thing. And as we're walking out the door, he says, "Dove, let me just tell you, you're gonna get a question and you're not gonna wanna answer it. And you just answer it this way," he said. "Senator, that's a very profound question. And I wouldn't do it justice by answering it now. And I will get back to you on it. And I thought, you know what? I wouldn't have thought of that. Arnold would have thought of that, but I wouldn't have. And I really was grateful, Tim, for that. And then I've got a humorous story as well about him. One time, Wolfowitz and I, Paul Wolfowitz, this was before we were in government. This was in the 90s. And Strom Thurmond, bless his soul, was chairman of the committee. But he was already well on into whatever it was by the 90s or whatever. And Wolfowitz shows up late. I was sitting there. And Strom Thurmond goes, "Dr. Zakheim, why did you show up so late?" And of course, it was Wolfowitz. So you could see Senator Warner, who basically was running the committee at that point, whispering to Thurmond that he got the people wrong. And Thurmond blows up and says, "Don't you tell me what I got wrong." And we, which if you ever knew Senator Thurmond, you can imagine the scene. And everybody just sat there with a straight face. And Warner, of course, had whispered to him so as not to embarrass him, because John Warner was the ultimate gentleman.
Indeed, indeed he was. And you mentioned Strom Thurmond, and all I remember having covered many hearings with Senator Thurmond. "Will you please speak into the machine?" Which is what he used to say all the time. Bob, memories from you?
It was 1994. I was up for confirmation as the Air Force comptroller, and Senator Warner was kind enough to do a courtesy interview. And it was almost all courtesy. And he asked about our family and told me I had two children and two sons who were teenagers at the time. And at the end, he said, "Well, I'll look forward to seeing you at the hearing, Mrs. Hale, and of course, your two sons." And I said, "Well, Senator, we had not planned to take our kids out of school for this." And there was a silence, and he looked at me, and I got gently but firmly scolded about the importance of family and how they should see this. And so we brought our children to the hearing, and Senator Warner came down before the hearing and introduced himself to them and talked to them. And he was just, as you've heard so many times, he was a genuinely nice human being. He had clear views, as he expressed, on the family, but he was just a nice person.
He certainly was. And, you know, the times that I've been complimented for my work when it came from him, it meant a lot given who he was. And again, a lifelong commitment of service to the nation. Cervello and Herson, any last thoughts on Senator Warner? Even though, Michael, you're going to try to portray this as if, you know, that was way before your day.
Well, I was, you know, I've been working in defense and politics since 1985. So, but I still was a young pup back then. But I do have actually a really good John Warner story, which kind of dovetails very well with the others. So when my wife was pregnant with our second child, and when she was very pregnant at the time, she was working for Senator Arlen Specter. And Specter was about to face a very tough primary for re-election to the Senate in Pennsylvania. So he asked Senator Warner, who was the chairman at the time of the Armed Services Committee, to come up and visit the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard with him so that he could help show all the people the great things that Senator Specter was helping to do there at the shipyard and protect jobs. So my wife picked up Senator Warner at the train station in Philadelphia, took him to the event, stayed with him all day, and then took him back to the train station. They were going to ride the train back together. And when they're at the train station, Senator Warner looked at her and said, "I'm not getting on the train until I buy you one of those big cookies over there. There's a snack stand with these enormous chocolate chip cookies." And my wife's like, "We're going to miss the train." He's like, "I don't care. I'm going to buy you this cookie because I see that you're pregnant and you haven't had anything to eat all day." And he went and he bought that cookie and they got on the train together and he made her eat that cookie on the train back. And it just goes to show what a decent and humane person that he really was.
Absolutely terrific. Cervello, any last thoughts, given that we're talking about a legendary Navy Marine Corps veteran?
Yeah, well, after his time in the Senate was done, he maintained his connection to the Navy and the Marine Corps. He would often come to visit other secretaries of the Navy or CNOs or other leaders. He was on a number of sort of formal or informal boards or committees to help Navy leaders. And no matter your rank, no matter what role you were playing, if he saw you in the P-way in the Pentagon, he went out of his way to say hello. And so, a giant for sure. I have enjoyed as a listener hearing the stories from my fellow guests.
I should also point out that John Warner's name will live on in the USS John Warner, the nuclear powered attack submarine of the Virginia class, SSN 785. I remember Senator Warner telling me, like, look, you know, you may have visited other subs, but this one is going to be the best sub in the United States Navy, with an enormous amount of pride. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back on. Hope you guys have a terrific holiday weekend. And we look forward again to having a deeper budget discussion after all of us have an opportunity to dive in to it and chew through the details. Thanks so much again for joining us. And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.